منها خبره صلى الله عليه وسلم الذي أخبر به عن أنه خاتم الأنبياء، وأعظم من ذلك وقبل ذلك خبر الله في كتابه العظيم، فإن من آمن بأنه رسول الله وأن الكتاب حق أيقن بأنه خاتم الأنبياء، لأن القرآن قال إنه خاتم الأنبياء، ولأنه قال أنا خاتم الأنبياء. قال الله جل وعلا: ما كان محمد أبا أحد من رجالكم ولكن رسول الله وخاتم النبيين. وتواترت الأحاديث عنه صلى الله عليه وسلم أنه قال: لا نبي بعدي، أنا خاتم الأنبياء لا نبي بعدي. فمن آمن بأنه رسول الله للمعجزات التي عرفها، والمعجزة القرآن من أعظم معجزة، القرآن نفسه أعظم معجزة دالها صدقه، لأن مثله لا يقوله بشر، ولا يأتي به أمي ولا يقرأ ولا يكتب، ولا يأتي به كاتب أيضا ولا قارئ، لما فيه من الأحكام العظيمة والأخبار المغيبة، ولما فيه من البلاغة والكمال البلاغة والإحكام والإتقان، وما فيه من أخبار عن يوم القيامة والآخرة لا يقدم عليها إلا من هو صادق معلم من جهة الله عز وجل. ثم ما جرى على يديه من المعجزات العظيمة من انشقاق القمر، فقد هذا من أعظم الآيات التي خصه الله بها، وهكذا ما جرى على يديه من دموع الماء من بين أصابعه، وشهاده المئات من الناس والجم الغفير من الناس مرات، والبركة في الطعام الذي دعا فيه فطار وهو قليل جدا يكفي المئات من الناس والجم الغفير من الناس، هو شيء يسير لا يكفي إلى الاثنين والثلاثة ونحو ذلك، ومع أشياء أخرى من المعجزات التي جرت على يديه عليه الصلاة والسلام. فمن آمن بنبوته صدق بأنه خاتم الأنبياء، وصدق بأن القرآن كلام الله، لأنه المعجزة العظمى. نعم.
إذ answer to the question that how do I know that Prophet Muhammad was the final messenger and his religion is true religion. He says this of course can be arrived at through various means. The first mean is through what the Prophet himself said about himself. He said, I am the messenger of God to you, and he was a person known by his truthfulness. He was known among his people as the honest one. They never recorded a single lie against him. So it was very clear, even one of the Caesars, when he asked about him and they said he's a well-known, truthful person, he said it is not conceivable that person never told a lie who will lie against God himself. This is just inconceivable. But not only this, also the Quran makes it very clear that Prophet Muhammad is messenger of God, and the Quran, for anybody who knows Arabic, cannot say, okay, this Quran is composed by Muhammad, because the speech of Muhammad and the Quran are two distinct and two different things, even for the this can be understood by any person who knows Arabic quite well. The third meaning is that Prophet Muhammad has brought various miracles, and those miracles, they are real proof that he was not talking just saying or claiming that he is the messenger of God, though he was not. And those miracles, as it is the nature of all miracles, or most of them, they took place during the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad. And there have been recorded more than 3,000 miracles of Prophet Muhammad during his lifetime. One of them is the split of the moon to the people in his time there. They saw it very clearly, and then they said, okay, maybe he was exercising some magic against our eyes. We will ask the people who are arriving from other areas, if they saw the moon at that specific night, two moons, then maybe it happened. But if it's only us in Mecca, he must have a kind of bewitched us, and he used his magic. Anyhow, the people, when they did come, they said, we saw the moon at that time as two moons, as it quite split. But not only this, of course, various miracles that took place during his lifetime, the increase of the food that was enough only for one or two people, about more than 200 people ate it from it, and his whole army, he was in the desert, and they have a small water, and he put his hand in that water, in a small, not cup, a larger pot, and from that, the water was gushing just like a spring, till the whole army was satisfied, and they filled their water skins and what have you, and so many other miracles that took place during the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad that makes it compulsory for his companion to believe in him. But the everlasting prophet, the everlasting miracle of Prophet Muhammad that can be witnessed even by the people who were not his contemporaries. I mean, all miracles usually they finished with their messengers, except the Quran. The Quran is an everlasting miracle which all people still can see even today. And if you read the Quran and look at it from the style point of view, you will be convinced that cannot be the speech of Muhammad or anybody. And the people, his contemporaries, they were quite clear at this point that this is the only thing they can say, this is magic. That is, no human being can produce. But even this, if you don't know the style of the Quran, again, you can't see the content of the Quran. The Quran has alluded and mentioned so many scientific facts that are only known in this century or in the century before. And Muhammad was a literate man who was raised in a non-scientific society, so to speak. So his knowledge there definitely cannot foretell all the various inventions that the Quran has mentioned and alluded to. The various laws in the Quran and all other things, once they are studied thoroughly, one will come to the conclusion that this book cannot be the production of Prophet Muhammad. It has to be the production of God, a superpower, not a human being. So by these, and using one, of course, being sincerely interested in finding the truth, I think one will come to the conclusion that Prophet Muhammad is, his religion is the true religion, and his message is the final message, because it is the most complete. You cannot add anything to it whatsoever.
This is another question. It says that you said that Muslims believe in all prophets, and that no distinctions to be made between them. But in the testimony of faith, a Muslim says there is no God but Allah and that Muhammad is his messenger. Doesn't that mean that you reject the other prophets?
يسأل يقول تقولون أن المسلم يؤمن برسل الله جميعا ولا يفرق بينهم ولكن في الشهادة التي يدخل بها الإنسان إلى الإسلام يقول المسلم أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمدا رسول الله أليس في ذلك رفض للأنبياء الآخرين؟
هذا يقوله أول ما يسلم لأن هذا هو الرسول الأخير أمر بأن يصدقه قبل أن يتكلم أهل الباقين لأنه هو الرسول المبعوث إليه في زمانه فعليه أن يسلم بهذه الشهادة شهادة أن لا إله إلا الله وأن محمد رسول الله ثم بعد ذلك يعلم ما يتعلق بالرسل جميعا حتى يؤمن به كما يعلم الملائكة والكتب والجنة والنار بعد ذلك فالشهادة بأن محمد رسول الله لابد منها مع شهادة أن لا إله إلا الله حتى يحكم بإسلامه ثم بعد ذلك يعلم بقية أمور الدين وهكذا في عهد عيسى يعلم بعيسى وما جاء به ثم بعد ذلك يعلم بالأنبياء الماضين حتى يؤمن بهم وهكذا في عهد موسى وهكذا في عهد من قبله يعلم برسوله المرسل إليه في زمانه ويؤمن به مع التوحيد ثم يؤمن بالبقية من بقية الرسل وبقية ما يؤمر به من الإيمان من الجنة والنار والملائكة والكتب هذا بعد إيمانه برسوله الذي في وقته الذي بعث إليه فمحمد صلى الله عليه وسلم هو الرسول الأخير هو الخاتم فوجب على الأمة التي في زمانه وبعد زمانه أن يؤمنوا به أولا مع التوحيد حتى بعد إيمانهم أن يصدقوا بالرسل قبله لأنه هو اللي خبر بهم فلا يمكن تصديق الماضين إلا بتصديق الحاضر الذي بلغ بهم هو الذي بلغ عنهم وأخبر عن الرسل الماضين فإذا صدقه المصدق حينئذ يصدق بالماضي نعم
His Eminence answer to the question that you Muslims say you believe in all the messengers of God, but the kalima or the declaration of faith indicate that you say you bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of God. And he said this is, the person says this when he became Muslim, when he enters the fold of Islam. But as a matter of fact, he will be required and he will be taught later on all these, the belief in all the messengers. And in a way, actually, the belief in the final messenger implies that the belief also in the previous messenger. And as a matter of fact, the Quran of the Muslim says very clearly in so many surahs and so many sayings of the Prophet ﷺ that the belief in the rest of the messengers is required. And we just heard from the Sheikh that one of the pillars of Islam is the belief in all the messengers of God. So it is a requirement, no doubt about it. But usually it is required from the individual who enters Islam because he is coming from other faith or maybe non-faith. So he declares the belief in Prophet Muhammad as the final and the greatest among the messengers. But this implies, of course, that he believes in the rest of the messengers. And it is very, very clear to every Muslim that if one says, I don't believe in just one single messenger, says, okay, for example, I don't believe in Moses. He's one of the Jews, and we have problems with the Jews now. I don't believe in him. This, of course, makes him a non-Muslim. So definitely, the belief in it does not the question indicates that declaring belief in Muhammad is not a rejection of the other messengers, but rather it is a confirmation in belief in the other messengers, because rejecting one messenger means rejecting them all.
He says that Quran says Allah created the universe, earth and skies, in 6 days. Can you explain this, knowing that for God it's only just say be and it will happen?
يقول القرآن أن الله سبحانه وتعالى خلق السماوات والأرض في 6 أيام. هل بإمكانكم توضيح ذلك لنا في ضوء معرفتنا بأنه يكفي أن يقول الله كن فيكون؟
نعم. خلق الله سبحانه السماوات والأرض وما بينهما في 6 أيام كما أخبره الصادق جل وعلا أنه خبر خلقها في 6 أيام وهو قادر أن يخلقها في لمحة بصر كما قال عز وجل إنما أمره إذا أراد شيئا أن يقول كن فيكون. ولكن ذكر العلماء رحمهم الله أنه خلقها في 6 أيام ليعلم عباده عدم العجلة وأن يتدبروا الأمور ويتعقلوها. فربهم الذي يعلم كل شيء وهو قادر على كل شيء لم يعجل في خلق السماوات ولا في خلق الأرض بل جعلها في 6 أيام ولم يعجل في خلق آدم ولم يعجل في خلق الأشياء الأخرى بل نظمها ودبرها أحسن تنظيم وأحسن تدبير ليعلم عباده التريث في الأمور وعدم العجلة في الأمور وأن يعملوا أمورهم منظمة موضحة تامة على بصيرة وعلى علم من دون عجلة وإخلال بما ينبغي فيها. فهو سبحانه مع كونه قادر على كل شيء وعالم بكل شيء مع ذلك لم يعجل بل خلقها في 6 أيام وهو قادر على خلقها في لمحة وفي دقيقة. إنما أمره يا شيء يكون فيكون سبحانه وتعالى. فجعلها منظمة مدبرة في أيام معدودات ليتعلم عباده كيف يعملون وكيف ينظمون أمورهم وكيف يتريثون في الأمور ولا يعجلون حتى تنتظم مصالحهم وحتى تستقيم أمورهم على طريقة واضحة وطريقة يطمئنون إليها فيها مصالحهم وفيها ما ينفعهم ويدفع الضرر عنهم.
His eminent answer to the question why did Allah create sky and earth in 6 days when he can't create them in a single second, or just as the Quran say be and it is there. It says this is of course maybe a lesson for mankind to learn that though Allah is capable of creating the whole universe in a glance, he created them in 6 days so that they will perform their action, they will lead their life according to a pre-arranged and a pre-planned procedure so that they should not be hasty in doing things. They should learn from the Creator, the one who is capable of creating the world in seconds. He created in that period of time so that they will follow that procedure. They will plan their activities. They will, in a way, think it over, because they are not that capable. They have their shortcomings, so they definitely do need time and do need planning and do need pre-thinking. So they should follow. So it is, in a way, a kind of symbolic symbolic indication for the creatures of God that they should follow pre-planned and well-thought action in their daily affairs and in their dealing with their various activities.
وقد أشار سبحانه إلى هذا المعنى في آيات، قال عز وجل: هو الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام وكان عرشه على الماء ليبلوكم أيكم أحسن عمل. فأخبرنا خلق هكذا ليبلونا، ليختبرنا أينا أحسن عملا وأثقل عملا وأكمل عملا. فالعجل الذي لا يتدبر في الأمور قد يخل بالعمل، فالله خلقها في ستة أيام ليبتلي العباد في إتقان أعمالهم وإحسان أعمالهم وعدم العجلة فيها حتى لا تختل شؤونهم وصالحهم. هو الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام وكان عرشه على الماء ليبلوكم أيكم أحسن عملا. قال سبحانه وتعالى: إنا جعلنا مع الأرض زينة لها لنبلوهم أيهم أحسن عملا. وجعل مع الأرض من جبال وأشجار ونبات وحيوانات ومعادن وغير ذلك ليبلو العباد، ليختبرهم أيهم أحسن عملا في استخراج ما في هذه الأرض وفي السماء والاستفادة من ذلك والانتفاع بذلك. قال سبحانه: الذي خلق الموت والحياة ليبلوكم أيكم أحسن عملا. ففي هذه الآيات وما جاء في معناها الدلالة على أنه سبحانه خلق هذه الأشياء بهذا التنظيم وبهذه المدة المعينة ليبلو عباده ويختبرهم أيهم أحسن عملا. ما قال أكثر عمل، قال أحسن، بالاعتبار بالإتقان والإكمال والإحسان لا بالكثرة.
He says that the Quran hinted to this, though not quite directly, but hinted to this meaning that God created skies and earth in 6 days, and his throne was on the ocean, and he did all this to test you, mankind, which among you will be best in his action and in his deed. And he emphasized the word best in action rather than more in action. Because here the emphasis is not on the quantity, it's rather on the quality. So the people should give a lot of thought on planning and a lot of thought in performing things the best as best as they can, so that the result of their work will be worthwhile and will be acceptable by God. So this is just the elaboration in the answer he gave.
He says, is there in Islam any restriction on women working or doing business? يسأل هل يمنع الإسلام عمل المرأة أو تجارتها؟
لا يمنع الإسلام عمل المرأة ولا تجارتها. الله جل وعلا شرع للعباد العمل وأمرهم، وقل اعملوا فسيرى الله عملكم ورسوله والمؤمنون ليبلوكم أيكم أحسن عملا. هذا للجميع، للرجال والنساء. وشرع التجارة للجميع، فالإنسان مأمور بأن يتجد ويتسبب ويعمل سواء كان رجلا أو امرأة. قال تعالى: يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا تأكلوا أموالكم بينكم بالباطل إلا أن تكون تجارة عن تراضي منكم. وهذا يعم الرجال والنساء جميعا. وقال: وأشهدوا وقال واستشهدوا شهيد الرجال فإن لم يكن رجلا واثنان من تضل الشهداء أن تضل إحداهما فذكر أحدهم أخرى ولا يبشر هذا المدعو ولا تسأموا أن تكتبوا خيرا في الأجل ذلكم أقسط عند الله وأقوم للشهادة وأن لا ترتابوا إلا أن تكون تجارة حاضرة تديرونها بينكم فليس عليكم جناح ألا تكتبوها. وهذا للرجال والنساء. فأمر بالكتابة عند الدين وأمر بالإشهاد، وبين أن هذا كله فيما يتعلق بالمداينات، فالكتابة في الدين والإشهاد عام. ثم قال: إلا أن تكون تجارة حاضرة فليس عليه جناح ألا تكتبوها. أما الإشهاد فيشهد ولهذا قال: وأشهد إذا تبعت. فهذا كله يعم الرجال والنساء، فالكتابة للرجال والنساء في الدين، والتجارة للرجال والنساء، والإشهاد للرجال والنساء، فيشهدون على بيعهم ويشهدون في تجاراتهم وكتاباتهم. ولكن التجارة الحاضرة لا حرج في عدم كتابتها لأنها تنقضي ولا يبقى لها علق، وهذا يعم الرجال والنساء جميعا. وهكذا ما جاء في النصوص في أمر الرجال والنساء في حديث النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم، حيث قال عليه الصلاة والسلام: البيعان بالخيار ما لم يتفرقا، فإن صدقا وبينا بورك لهما في بيعهما، وإن كتما وكذبا محقت بركة بيعهما. وقال: وأحل الله البيع، قال سبحانه: وأحل الله البيع وحرم الربا، يعني للجميع. نعم.
His answer to the question that is there any restriction by Islam on women to participate or to work or deals in trade? He says there is no restriction. Trading or working actually is something that is men and women are addressed to do. Allah says, or work or perform, and Allah will see the results of your performance. Allah and His Messenger will see the results of your performance. And also, this life actually is a big field where people are to work and they are tested to work. So they are all addressed, men and women, to perform and work. So Islam does not really put any restriction in this area. He quoted various verses that had to do with trade or writing actually among the people who are dealing with each other. And again, he indicated that they apply to men as well as to women.
لكن يجب أن يلاحظ في العمل وفي التجارة أن تكون الخلطة بينهم خلطة بريئة بعيدة عن كل ما يسبب المشاكل واقتراف المنكرات، فيكون عمل المرأة على وجه لا يكون فيه اختلاط بالرجال ولا تسبب للفتنة، ويكون كذلك تجارتها هكذا على وجه لا يكون فيه فتنة مع العناية بالحجاب والستر والبعد عن أسباب الفتنة. هذا يلاحظ في البيع والشراء وفي الأعمال كلها، لأن الله قال جل وعلا: وقرنا في بيوتهن وقرنا في بيوتكن ولا تبرجن تبرج الجاهلية الأولى. وقال سبحانه: وإذا سألتمهن متاعا فاسألوهن من وراء حجاب ذلكم أطهر لقلوبكم وقلوبهن. قال سبحانه: يا أيها النبي قل لأزواجك وبناتك ونساء المؤمنين يدنين عليهن من جلابيبهن. فبيعهن وشراؤهن على حدة بينهن لا بأس له، والرجال على حدة، وهكذا أعمالهن. هذه تعمل طبيبة في النساء، ممرضة للنساء، تعلم النساء لا بأس، وهذا طبيب للرجال وهذا يعلم الرجال لا بأس. أما أن تكون طبيبة للرجال والرجل طبيبا للنساء، أو تكون ممرضة للرجال والرجل يكون ممرضا للنساء، هذا مما يأبه الشرع لما فيه من الفتن والفساد. فلا بد مع السماح بالعمل لها وللرجل والتجارة لها وللرجل أن يكون ذلك على وجه ليس فيه خطر على دينها وأرضها، وليس خطر على الرجل، بل تكون أعمالها على وجه ليس فيه ما يسبب تعرضا لدينها وأرضها، ولا يسبب أيضا فساد الرجال وفتنة الرجال، وهكذا أعمال الرجال فيما بينهم لا يكون بينهم من النساء ما يسبب الفتنة والفساد، بل هؤلاء لهم أعمال وهؤلاء لهم أعمال على طريقة سليمة ليس فيها ما يضر هذا الصنف ولا هذا الصنف، ولا يضر المجتمع نفسه.
That though Islam has not put any restriction in women to work or deal in trade, they should be or should be kept in mind that while doing this, they should be dressed decently, and there should be no kind of pre-mingling with men. So any job that will lead to free mingling with men that might lead to moral corruption or might lead to some problems that are usually result from this kind of free mixing, then Islam is against this. Other than that, definitely women are welcome to work. They perform a lot of jobs that are needed by women in schools and hospitals and everywhere. Experience and work of the men are needed. But what sometimes happens that we have, let's say, women working for men and men working for women. I don't think Islam really allows this, and it leads to some other evils that Islam would like to avoid. So to have a woman doctor dealing with men, or a male doctor dealing with ladies, this Islam does not allow, except in the extreme cases of necessity.
But the best procedure is to have ladies working for ladies and men working for men.
يستثنى من ذلك ما تدعو الضرورة إليه، إذا دعت الضرورة إلى أن يتولى الرجل عملا مع المرأة كطبها تطبيبها عند عدم وجود امرأة تطبها، أو عمل المرأة في حق الرجل عند عدم وجود من يطبه ويتعرف داءه ومرضه تطبه مع الحشمة والبعد عن أسباب الفتنة ومع البعد عن الخلوة وما أشبه ذلك. فإذا كان هناك عمل من المرأة مع الرجل أو من الرجل مع المرأة في حاجة في ذلك وضرورة إلى ذلك مع مراعاة البعد عن أسباب الفتنة من الخلوة والتكشف ونحو ذلك مما قد يسبب الفتن، فهذا سيكون باب الاستثناء. فلا بأس أن تعمل المرأة فيما يحتاجه الرجل وما يعمل الرجل فيما تحتاجه المرأة على وجه لا يكون فيه خطر على الاثنتين، كان تطبه عند عدم وجود طبيب يطبه وهي تعرف مرضه.
Also the exception he eminence added is that there are certain cases of exception where necessity arises. Suppose in an area in a hospital where we do not have a lady specialist and women need to be treated. In this case they can be treated by a male doctor, but again with necessary caution or caution of being decently dressed and no kind of other behavior that might lead to either result. And this is true of various other things. Also when a woman is selling in the market or what have you, she should keep this in mind where she should not be victimized by men or being a cause of moral corruption. There is no restriction in that. Other than that there is no restriction.
ومن هذا ما فعله النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم، فإنه صلى الله عليه وسلم ربما حطب النساء وسمع له النساء وذكرهم، هذا مما يفعله الرجل مع النساء. كان صلى الله عليه وسلم في صلاة العيد إذا فرغ من الخطبة ذكر الرجال، أتى النساء وذكرهن ووجههن إلى الخير، وهكذا في بعض الحيطات يجتمعن ويذكرهن عليه الصلاة والسلام ويعلمهن ويجيب عن أسئلتهن، هذا من هذا الباب. وهكذا بعده صلى الله عليه وسلم ويذكرهم الرجل ويعظهم ويعلمهم مع اجتماعهم على طريقة حميدة مع التستر والتحفظ والبعد عن أسباب المثلة. فإذا دعت الحاجة إلى ذلك قام الرجل بالمهمة مهمة الوعظ والتذكير والتعليم مع الحجاب والتستر ونحو ذلك مما يبتعد يبعد الرجل من الفتنة.
And this is part of what the Prophet himself did actually. He used to lecture to the ladies in public places and also some other eminent scholars and others. So when they are decently dressed and there is no kind of immoral mixing or any other ethical corruption. So it can be done as a lecture or a party. Women also participate in prayer in the mosque. But again, it is Islam is a moral religion and gives a lot of emphasis on that aspect, because again, any evil that might be caused in the society should be forbidden.
A first brother is asking about in Islam, does the wife should be from the same religion as the husband or not?
هذا أخ يسأل هل يجب أن تكون الزوجة والزوج في الإسلام نفس الدين؟ هل يجب أن تتبع الزوجة دين زوجها في الإسلام؟
هذا فيه تفصيل. إن كان الزوج مسلما وهي كتابية محصنة يهودية أو نصرانية فلا بأس باختلاف الدين، بل لا بأس أن يتزوج الرجل المسلم الكتابية وهي المحصنة من اليهود والنصارى، لأن الله أجل في هذا سبحانه وتعالى في قوله جل وعلا: اليوم أحل لكم الطيبات وطعام يطيبون لكم وطعام يطيبون لهم والمحصنات من المؤمنات والمحصنات من الذين من قبلكم إذا آتيتموهن أجورهن محصنين غير مسارعين ولا مستحضرين أحزابا. فإذا خطب المؤمن المسلم خطب كتابية محصنة معروفة بالإحصان غير مسافة غير صغير معروفة بأن حافظ وفقها ليست من البغايا والزواري فإذا خطبها وزوجها إذا كتابية يهودية أو نصرانية محصنة فلا بأس بذلك. أما قولها كافرة غير يهود النصارى فلا، إنما أباح الله سبحانه كتابية فقط للرجل المسلم. وقال في الآية الأخرى جل وعلا: ولا تنكحوا المشركات حتى يؤمنوا، وقال: ولا تنكحوا المشركين حتى يؤمنوا، هكذا في سورة البقرة. قال في سورة المنتحين: لا هن حل لهم ولا هم يحلون لهم. والأصل أنه لا يحل المسلم نكاح كافرة ولا يحل المسلم نكاح كافرة، هذا هو الأصل، لا يحل هذا هذا ولا هذا. بل لا بد أن يتفق في الدين مسلم مع مسلمة أو كافر مع كافر، لكن في حال واحدة يستثنى اختلاف الدين، وهي إذا كان الرجل مسلما الزوج مسلما والمرأة كتابية فقط، المرأة كتابية يهودية أو نصرانية محصنة تصل إحصانا مع سليمة عبيدة، فلا بأس أن ينكحها المسلم خاصة كما سن الله ذلك في سورة المائدة. وما عدا الكتابية فليس للمسلم نكاحها يهودية أو وثنية أو شيوعية أو غير ذلك، وليس للمسلمة أن تنكح كافرا أبدا، المسلمة ليس لها أن تنكح كافرا أبدا، وإنما الاستثناء بالمرأة مع المسلم، فالمسلم هو الذي يستثنى لحقه نكاح اليهودية أو النصرانية يعني كتابية خاصة دون بقية الكفار. أما الأنثى فليس لها أن تنكح كافرا أبدا، إذا كانت مسلمة ليس لها أن تنكح إلا مسلما، لقوله تعالى: لا هن حل لهم ولا هم يحلون لهم، ولقوله عز وجل: ولا تنكحوا المشركين إلا تزوجوا حتى يؤمنوا، نكحوا إلا تزوجوا. نعم.
His answer to the question that can a Muslim marry non-Muslim wife is that this needs some kind of return. That Islam allows a Muslim to marry a Christian or a Jewish woman if she is morally, I mean, sound and not known as a prostitute or anything of the sort. But this is only, this is privilege given to the people of the scripture, that is the Jews and the Christian, because they have revelation and they are followers of a religion that is originally from God. For other faiths or non-believers, especially polytheists or people who are pagans or what have you, a Muslim is not allowed to marry them. This is in the case of the man. In the case of a Muslim woman, she is not allowed at all to marry a non-Muslim person. Of course, he didn't give the detail why, but you can see why, because Islam considers the man to be the leader of the family, and if that leader of the family is tries to force the Muslim woman to change his, her religion, this is definitely is a tragedy. Besides, also Islam recognizes Christianity and Judaism as a religion from God, but not the opposite. They do not recognize Islam as a religion from God, and so it is expected, though it's not necessarily will happen, that they might, the man might exploit his role as the leader of the family and cause the woman to change his religion.
For our sisters in the other hall, if they have any questions, please use the mic in front of you. Here I have a question, says, is visiting the graves and shrines of holy men permitted in Islam? يسأل هل زيارة قبور وأضرحة الأولياء جائزة في الإسلام؟
الزيارة فيها تفصيل، زيارة القبور والأولياء والمؤثرين للاعتبار والذكرى للموت والآخرة والدعاء لهم والترحم عليهم هذه مشروعة، لقول النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم: زوروا القبور فإنها تذكركم الآخرة. وكان النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم يعلم أصحابه إذا زاروا قبورا يقولوا: السلام عليكم أهل الديار من المؤمنين والمسلمين، وإنا إن شاء الله بكم لاحقون، نسأل الله لنا ولكم العافية. فالزيارة الشرعية ويتخص الرجال دون النساء، لأنه صلى الله عليه وسلم لعن زيارة القبور، فدل ذلك على أن هذه الزيارة تخص الرجال. كانت الزيارة ممنوعة أولا في أول الإسلام، ممنوعة لأنهم قد اعتادوا التعلق بالأموات، فكان من حكمة الله أن نهاهم عن الزيارة أو جميع رجال ونساء، ثم رخص لهم الزيارة رجال ونساء، ثم استقر المنع للنساء وبقي الإذن للرجال، لأن النساء قد لا يقبلن، قد يحصل لهن فتنة عند زيارة القبور لتذكر أقاربهم وأصحابهم وأزواجهم ونحو ذلك. فكان من حكمة الله أن منعهن من زيارة القبور لئلا يحتكن أو يحتكن غيرهن، وأقر هذا للرجال خاصة. فهي يؤخذ منها الذكرى والترحم على الموتى والاستغفار لهم وتذكر الآخرة، حتى لو كانوا كفارا وميتين، إذا زار القبور للذكرى فقط لا يدعو لهم ولا يسلم عليهم لأنهم كفار، إنما يزور للذكرى كما زار النبي أمه وكان مات في الجاهلية واستغفر ربه ويستغفر الله فلا يؤذن له، فزارها فقط مجرد اختبار. فالقبور التي للمسلمين تزار للدعاء لهم وتذكر الآخرة والموت والاستغفار للموتى فقط، وإن كان الموتى كفارا فالزيارة للذكرى والاعتبار فقط. أما النوع الثاني من الزيارة فهي غير جائزة، وهي أن يزورهم لدعائهم والاستغاثة بهم والنذر لهم وطلبهم المدد والعون والغوث أو التمسح بقبورهم وأحجارهم أو الطواف بها، هذا لا يجوز. هذه الزيارة لا تجوز التي يفعلها بعض الجهلة، يزور القبور ليسألوهم ويستغيثوا بهم، كما يقع هذا في بعض الأحيان من بعض الجهلة مع بدوي أو مع الحسين أو مع الشيخ عبد القادر في العراق أو غير ذلك، هذا لا يجوز. الزيارة هي نوعان، شرعية وممنوعة بالدين. فالشرعية هي يزار للترحم عليهم وذكر الآخرة وذكر الموت فقط، فهذه شرعية مطلوبة مأمور بها. الزيارة الثانية بدعية منكرة، وهي أن يزور القبور لدعاء الموتى والاستغاثة بالموتى أو الدعاء بهم والتوسل بهم أو التمسك بقبورهم أو الطواف بها أو الصلاة عندها، هذا ممنوع، وهو مختلف أنواع، بعضه شرك وبعضه بدعة. الصلاة عندها والجلوس عندها للدعاء هذا بدعة، أما الطواف بهم ليدفعوا له أو لينفعوه أو دعاؤهم أو الاستغاثة بهم أو النذر لهم أو طلب المدد، هذا من الشرك الذي حرمه الله ونهى عنه.
Yeah, the question was about visiting the shrines of the saints or tombs, if this is allowed in Islam. And his eminent answer is that there is some detail in this. There are two types of reason for visiting the grave. If we visit the grave to be reminded of the hereafter and that this life is temporary, it's going to end one day, this is commended in Islam. That we always should be aware that we are going to die one day, and we should prepare ourselves for that destiny. And of course, the best thing to remind us of this is to visit the grave, and also to pray for those people who are dead there, ask God mercy on them, and that if they are tortured, their torture will be listened, and they will be safe, and this and that. And this is because they are Muslims. If they are not Muslims, one should not pray for them, because the Prophet himself, he visited the grave of his mother or the tomb of his mother, and he was allowed to visit her, but he was not allowed to pray for her because she died as non-Muslim or non-believer. There is the other type of visiting of the shrines, the tombs, which is quite rejected in Islam. That is to visit them to seek their help and to worship them instead of God, or to ask their blessings and what have you. All these are of course forbidden in Islam, because it is part of the Islamic belief that the only one that has the power to bring harm or to bring benefit is Allah, and not the people in the grave or the shrine. Even if they are saints or what have you, still they cannot help a bit, and so they should not be approached for that purpose. Rather, they need one to pray for on their behalf and to get Allah's mercy and blessing. So these two types, one of them is recommended and this is part of worship, the other one is rejected, and it may amount to associating God with the one alone God.
A sister from the lady question says, I'd like to become a Muslim. And she asks, what are the procedures for that?
هذه أخت من قسم النساء تقول أنها تريد أن تعلن إسلامها.
وتسأل ما هي الإجراءات اللازمة لذلك.
يحضر إن شاء الله بعد الظهر غدا ونسمعها ونعطيها وليقع الله
Yeah. Sister there in the lady section asked if one would like to become Muslim or she would like to become Muslim, what are the procedures? And she said, okay, she may come to me tomorrow afternoon in the department of Islam and we will do the necessary procedures. And this is my footnote, by the way. There is no, complicated procedures or ceremony of baptism or any sort of things that usually associated in the minds of people. The only thing required is to, of course, get introduced to the basic tenets of Islam, the basic principles of Islam, and then to declare that you believe in this and you believe in God and believe in Prophet Muhammad and the rest of the messengers. This is the only procedure. But of course, there are some papers people might need them. That will be part of that.
وفق الله الجميع ما هو فيه وأخذ حرية الجميع صلى الله وسلم على نبينا محمد وآله وصحبه.
Okay, in your name I thank His Eminence for this brief introduction to Islam, and I'd like to also announce about the lecture that Brother Abdul Ilah mentioned. This coming Wednesday there will be a lecture in this place at 8:30, and it's going to be by His Excellency Dr. Abdullah Nafis. And the good news, or part of the good news, that you won't be bothered by my translation, because Dr. Abdullah Nafis will be talking in English directly with no translation, because I do really hate this business of translation, and I seek your permission and your indulgence in this, and also his eminence forgiveness, because especially instant translation is usually quite difficult, and I think I must have committed some of the things that is indicated in the Chinese proverb that translators are traitors. I hope that I am not a traitor, or at least if I did some kind of it was not intentional by any means. So thank you very much for your time, and hope to see you in this hall next Wednesday at 8:30. Thank you very much.
تقول لهم أيضا من كان عنده سؤال بأي لغة من اللغات أرسله إلى دار الإفتاء باسم عبد الله بن طوال الناس, وهو إن شاء الله يجاب على سؤال بلغته.
Also, if there is any question in your language or in any language of Islam in general, they may be sent to His Eminence Sheikh Abdul Aziz Baz in Dar al-Ifta, and he will be pleased to answer you in writing and also in your in the language you are. Okay. Thank you very much.
بارك الله فيك. 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 بارك
الله فيك.
بارك
الله
فيك.
أيها الأخوة الكريم, ترجو تسجيل الأخوة الإسلامية للرياض التي قامت بتسجيل هذه المادة من الأخوة الكرام إبلاغها بأي خلل إنجازي في التسجيل, ومن ثم إعادة الشريط استفادة وتفاهم الخير.
السلام عليكم. Peace be upon you, ladies and gentlemen. And welcome to a new episode of Islam in Focus. I am Muhammad Hosni, and I will be acting as your host on today's program. We have been promising you for several weeks now a series of episodes dealing with the fundamental teachings and tenets of Islam, and I am happy to announce to you today that today's program will be the first in that series. With us today is Dr. Gamal Badawi, professor at St. Mary's University, and he will help us to elucidate some of the basic concepts and maybe define some of the fundamental terminology that will be necessary prerequisite for any reasonable understanding of the wealth of ideas comprised in Islam. Dr. Gamal, welcome to our program. And I think the best point to start at is the extent of the Muslim presence in the world, and whether every Muslim is an Arab and every Arab is a Muslim, as a lot of people may tend to believe.
see, the whole notion of a Muslim being an Arab in long flowing robes of a camel or horse is a kind of stereotype that seems to have been deliberately perpetrated by the media. Not only by the media, but even some of the more respectable writings seem somehow to imply this kind of a stereotype. Indeed, you'd be surprised to know that Muslims, the Arab section of Muslims, in fact, constitute a small minority among Muslims. In other words, the Muslims who are Arabs at the same time constitute nearly 15%. That's almost one-seventh of the total world population, or Muslim population, I should say. In fact, the reverse also is true, that not every Arab is a Muslim. In other words, there are many Arabs also who are Christians or Jews and have been for years living in Arab countries. So this is, like I said, it's a kind of false stereotype that is normally associated with everything from Popeye the Sailor Man to cartoons and papers to writings. It's not a true picture. Indeed, the total Muslim world population gets quite close to 1 billion. There are various estimates. Some are somewhat underestimated. One recent issue of the Time magazine estimated the total Muslims all over the world at 750 million. There are other studies that show it's actually closer to 1 billion Muslims all over the world. But in any case, that would place it either as the largest faith, universal faith on earth, or at least a close second, because according to the same Time issue, it estimates the total number of followers of Christianity with various sects, Protestantism, Catholicism, and Eastern Orthodox, and all others combined at 985 million. So that, like I said, puts Islam either the largest faith, if you take 1 billion as the estimate, or a close second, really. So it's a universal religion, really, rather than something that's necessarily connected with the Arabs. I might give you some examples of places where people only hear about when news breaks about. Most people would think of Muslims, if not only limited to the Arabs, as mainly concentrated in African or Asian countries. Of course, in combined Asia and Africa, there should be close to 700 million Muslims, and definitely this is the largest concentration. But on the other hand, there are also many places in the world where Muslims have even a majority outside of Asia and Africa. Yes, for example, in Europe, Turkey is close to 98 or 99% Muslim. Albania, which is now under communist occupation, estimated, even according to the Time magazine, some people even would place the estimate at higher than that, but according to the Time estimate, there is about 70% of the total population in Albania are Muslim. There have been several reports also relatively recently showing that on Europe as a whole, on the continental level, Muslims constitute the second largest religion in Europe, or faith followed in Europe. Besides this, of course, and this might explain sometimes the discrepancy between the estimates, there are many places where Muslims constitute a substantial minority also. In Russia, for example, after the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, many questions have been raised about the effect of that Islamic revival on the Muslim population under Russian occupation, which are estimated now at about 50 million Muslims. That's almost 25% of the total Soviet Union. In China, there's at least 20 million, perhaps more than that. In India, even though Muslims are a minority, they're a substantial minority of 80 million. In addition, of course, to Muslim presence in considerable minorities in places like the Philippines, in North America, even to some extent, there's presence which is growing in many other places in the world. In fact, to reflect or show the universality of Islam as a universal faith, there's nearly 120 different countries in the world or more which has Muslims as either minority or majority. In 57, roughly, 57 countries, the Muslims constitute a substantial majority of the population. So the notion, like I said, basically,
sure, a lot of people would find it very strange to believe that a place like Russia has 50 million Muslims, whereas Egypt is considered an Islamic country through and through, has less than that.
Right.
Okay, having established that not every Arab is a Muslim and not every Muslim is an Arab, maybe we should move to the following point, the following misconception, which is Islam being always talked about as a religion, like Christianity is a religion, Judaism is a religion, or any other of the religions of the world. And then the problem of sacred versus secular, which is almost becoming a proverbial dichotomy, and whether this dichotomy really exists in Islam at all.
You see, the whole notion of so-called sacred versus secular is something that stemmed largely in Western thinking. And for most people in the West, when you mention the word religion, it's automatically tied in their minds with the ritualistic or spiritual aspect of life, something just of acts of worship. And according to this, this seemed to be an implication that life is compartmentalized in two major components.
Right.
One component is sacred or religious, the other is secular. The religious part concerns itself mainly with the spiritual and moral aspects of life, the personal relationship between the person and the creator, while the secular aspect is everything else. That is, everything that does not fall within the boundaries of this very limited definition of what religion is would fall under the secular, and as such religion does not really play a very significant role as a regulatory force in the social, economic or political life of the individual. The Muslim find that kind of dichotomy unacceptable and quite inconsistent, in fact, with the nature of Islam as the Muslim understand it. At least there are three basic reasons for that. On the etymological level, the word itself, religion, in the Western dictionary, if you get the equivalent of that in Arabic, it's the word millah, really, not deen as we use it in the
Which
Arabic.
Which is not the word we use for Islam.
Exactly, we don't use it for that. It means simply, you know, something which is limited and ritualistic. But the actual word used for quote-unquote religion, as, again, a broader term, is deen in Arabic, D-E-E-N, which means a way or a way of life. And as such,
it doesn't really have an exact word in English, right?
No, I don't think that there's any single English word really that would convey
the
total meaning or
totality of meaning.
Right. And that's why I have some reservation about they use the term religion to refer to Islam, because the religion is connotated in the minds of most Western audience with this limited conception. But like I said, if I may put it in more than one word, as a way of life, a total guidance in life, then it follows from that that there is no compartmentalization, that there is no separation between religious and secular, or sacred and secular, because you could worship God in a way by following his commands and way of life in your socio-economic political life that people call secular, and you can also conduct the so-called secular activities according to the injunctions and broad guidance that is provided by revelation. This is one thing. The second major area, of course, that reflect on this dichotomy is that historically speaking, the development of Muslim civilization has been quite different than what happened in the West. For example, in the case of Islam, the more people were sincere in the application of their faith in the various facets of their life, the more they had material progress and civilization.
Prosperity.
And prosperity. Yeah. The more they deviated from the pristine teachings of their faith, the more they became backward.
Yeah.
In other words, there was a complete harmonious correspondence between following the precepts of the faith as a total way of life and progress and civilization. And the reverse is true. And this, of course, stands in contrast to what happened, for example, in Europe, where the trend actually was reversed.
It was exactly the opposite.
It was exactly the opposite.
That's right.
That's why it is very important for students of Islam, especially if they don't have, you know, the Islamic background, or they don't really have the commitment, not to try to interpret Islam and put it in the Western frame of reference. Or they have to interpret Islam as it is.
So-called separation of church and state.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is totally irrelevant, really, in the mind of the Muslim altogether.
Mm-hmm. Good. So at this point, we have cleared up exactly where the Muslims are in the world, whether all Muslims are Arabs or not. And we have cleared the misconception, the common misconception, that Islam is just another religion, and that secular and sacred should be dichotomized, should be separated in Islam like in any other faith or any other religion. Now, in a lot of the literature about Islam, some of the most notable references in our university libraries about Islam call it Mohammedanism. As a matter of fact, the famous book of Sir Hamilton Gibb, which is one of the main references of Islam, is called Mohammedanism. Is this a proper name? And why do Muslims never use that name, and it's only used in the West?
It is like one scholar put it, he says, the misunderstanding of Islam starts with its very name.
That's right, yeah.
For the Muslim, no, it's not the same. Mohammedanism is not an alternative name for Islam. In fact, it is regarded as an offensive and improper title to give to the Muslims, no matter how spread. And that includes also the various derivatives of the word, like referring to Muslims as Mohammedans instead of Muslims, followers of Muslims.